to get to a very narrow area where they're being escorted to the buses. I haven't seen one bus leave yet.
Please, babe. 6 and 8 months. The people just walking past us.
No food, no water, no nothing. Whatever we had, we've been taking it. That's the only way we could survive.
They got the food right here. Let me show you right here. All of it. Look, right here. Look. They won't give us nothing.
Yourself, bro. Everything. Open the gate right there.
Look. They won't give us nothing. We ain't drinking no ice water, nothing.
It's not about low income. It's not about rich people, poor people. It's about people. Nobody wants to hurt anybody in this city. Nobody wants to hurt these people who have these businesses.
And they want a little air and a little food and water, for God's sake. That's it.
There's nobody in charge. The National Guard, the police, there is nobody. Somebody needs to come take charge and put organization and get these people to safety, to get them clothes, the basic things that they need to live from day to day.
Well, we've been people being killed down here. People said their bodies were just lying out in the street. They were shooting each other. The military was shooting. One of my neighbors said the military guy shot at him. So that's what made me not want to come down here.
Federal relief officials have played almost no role. The head of FEMA, Michael Brown, admitted on CNN last night his agency didn't even know that thousands of hungry refugees were inside the convention center. Residents continue to break into stores in search of everything from food and water to guns to luxury items.
Nobody here but us, and we just got to look out for one another. All your politicians, they want to get on TV talking about feeding this person, feeding that person. We ain't seen nothing over there yet.
The White House announced it would have zero tolerance for looters, even for those taking essential items needed to stay alive.
Well, I want zero tolerance for that kind of language being used by leaders of our government to discuss poor people, poor black people who are trying to survive under the most desperate, insane circumstances. I want zero tolerance for thousands of our troops being sent to Iraq when we need them here.
I hate the way they portray us in the media. If you see a black family, it says they're looting. See a white family, it says they're looking for food.
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
In Biloxi, Mississippi, the first federal aid arrived only yesterday, 3 full days after the storm wiped out entire sections of the city. In smaller towns in Mississippi, help has still not arrived.
We left for the hurricane and came back Monday night hoping that we could help some people because, I don't know, looking at the response to this storm, particularly initially, there wasn't a lot of outside help. So we decided that really it was up to the people of Jefferson Parish to take the parish back.
What I saw from the federal government was a grand total of 3 boats. Border Patrol agents on 3 boats, 2 airboats and 1 flat-bottom boat. And I saw far more of a response from citizens who had just taken it upon themselves to go and pluck people out of their homes. And they plucked about a dozen out on Saturday.
We don't have any government response here. Everything that's taken place is taken place by volunteers and citizens in the area. Why aren't there 50 inflatable boats in the water working a grid, making sure all these people are out of here? Why is it just volunteers? That's the only people you see around.
FEMA Director Mike Brown is in charge of all federal response and recovery efforts in the field.
And Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job.
That's Democratic true. Leader Nancy Pelosi has called for your resignation, and I'm wondering if you have a response to that.
The president's in charge of that, not me.
Well, right at the top, you have Michael Brown, and as you mentioned, he was the commissioner of judges at the International Arabian Horse Association. To give you an idea of what he did there, he spent a year investigating whether a breeder performed liposuction on a horse's rear end.
This is an attempt by some in this room to engage in finger-pointing and blame game, and I'm just not going to do that. I've made it very clear. And the president spoke about him last week, and his comments stand in terms of what he has said about the great work that they've been doing round the clock, 24 hours a day, to help people on the ground.
Excerpts of Democracy Now!'s coverage of Hurricane Katrina 20 years ago. That last speaker was Scott McLennan, who served as spokesperson for then-President George W. Bush. The massive storm struck the Gulf Coast on August 29, 2005. Democracy Now! Soon went down to report from the streets of New Orleans.
One person we interviewed in the neighborhood of Algiers was Malik Rahim, co-founder of the Common Ground Collective. On September 10th, 2005, we aired this report. When Malik took us around the corner from a community health center, he showed us how a corpse still remained on the street. It had been neglected since Hurricane Katrina hit. We asked soldiers and police why the corpse had not been picked up.
Basically, smell it from right here. You know, and the police, they pass by, they'll look at it, but they ain't gonna do nothing, you know, to pick it up.
Malik then walked us down the driveway next to the health center and lifted up a sheet of corrugated metal marked with an X, revealing the dead body underneath.
Now, his body been here for almost 2 weeks, 2 weeks tomorrow, all right, that this man been body been laying here. And there's no reason for it. Look where we at. I mean, it's not flooded. There's no reason for them to be and left that body right here like this. I mean, that's just totally disrespect. You know, and I mean, 2 weeks, every day we ask him about come and pick it up. And they refuse to come and pick it up. And you can see it's literally decomposing right here, right out in the sun. Every day we sit up and we ask them about it. Because, I mean, this is the closest you could get to tropical climate in America. And they won't do anything with it.
Malik, do you know who this person is?
No. But regardless of who it is, I wouldn't care if it's Saddam Hussein or Bin Laden. Nobody deserves to be left here. And the kids pass by here and they're seeing it. I mean, the elderly, this is what's frightening a lot of people into leaving. We don't know if he's a victim of vigilantes or what, but that's all we know is that his body has been allowed to remain out here for over 2 weeks.
We're standing right outside the health clinic. Its doors are chained. The building is not in seriously damaged. No. Have you reached people there? What authorities have you talked to pick up this body?
We're going to talk to everyone from the Army to the New Orleans Police to the state troopers. We're going to talk to everybody who we can. I even talked to Oliver Thomas, who was the councilman at large yesterday, about this body. He said he was surprised to see that this body is still there. But it's 2 weeks. 2 weeks that this man been just laying here.
As Malik Rahim was speaking, as if on cue, every level of authority he mentioned drove by.
There's a dead body right here. Who are you with?
We're with Bravo 15.
Which is?
The CAV.
Army.
Army, yes, regular Army.
There's a dead body right here. Can you guys pick it up?
I don't think we can pick it up, but we can call the local authorities to come and pick it up.
This gentleman who lives in the neighborhood said that they have been trying to get... Here, let me ask these guys, too. Excuse me? Hi, there's a dead body right here. Can Louisiana State Troopers, can you pick it up?
You need to talk to our public information officer, ma'am.
It's been here for 2 weeks. We filmed it last week, and the gentleman over here said he's been trying to get it picked up for 2 weeks, and Louisiana State Troopers, the police, the Army, no one has responded. We're looking right over at it right there.
You need to talk to our public information officer and contact them at the troop.
Your name is?
You need to talk to our public information officer.
Do you know about the body?
You need to talk to our public information officer.
Sir, do you know about the body over there?
Ma'am, you talk with our public information officer.
Do you know what they should do to get this body removed?
I have no idea. I can't tell you. I don't know. There's been several people over here looking at it.
That was Homeland Security that just went by. Sir, what were you saying?
There's been several people over here looking at it, but, you know, like I said, I haven't seen anybody take it.
Several Army guys?
I've seen police over here looking at it. I've seen ambulances looking at it. That's about it.
To our knowledge, the body was never identified. Malik Rahim is the co-founder of the Common Ground Collective, which helped bring thousands of people from all over the world to help rebuild New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. He was also one of the founders of the New Orleans chapter of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. In 2008, he was a congressional candidate for the Green Party. He's joined us over the years since then. I recently went back to New Orleans and interviewed Malik Rahim again. Malik, we are sitting here at the Morial Convention Center, where 20 years ago, thousands of people were taking refuge from Hurricane Katrina. Your thoughts on what happened back then and the lessons for today?
Well, I would have to first, I have to thank you for this time. When I think of what happened, not only here, I have to also think about what was happening in Algiers. And I have to think of the role that you and Democracy Now played at that time. Most mainstream media was sold on a big lie that this city had resorted to anarchy, that it was taken over by thugs, and there was looting, there was murder, there was rapes that was going on. And that now, 20 years later, we know that all this was false. But it was an excuse. It was an excuse in order to rid the city out of people that was no longer tolerated. It was a difference between those who seek safety at the Superdome than those who seek safety here. Because the ones at the Superdome was there seeking safety from Hurricane Katrina. But those that was here, those that was the tens of thousands that was stuck up in this building, wasn't as cool as it is now. Didn't have any air. But they was fleeing a flood, a known flood. They was fleeing hurricane corruption, hurricane racism. You know, that's the hurricane that they was fleeing for. And they wasn't able to bring supplies with them. Most people, when that flood came, that's all they had was the clothes on their back. And then they had to wear these polluted clothes because the water was polluted. The water was toxic. And they had to wear this for days. So I think about the condition of those that was trapped here, and especially the children. You know, as an elder, I can understand. But, you know, because I'm in the twilight of my life. I'll be 78 in December. So I'm in the twilight of my life. But for to see children trapped up in here and dying needlessly.
Remind me, this was George W. Bush's presidency. He had appointed as the head of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Michael Brown,
who was his specialty was Arabian horses. He was more concerned about the size of his cuffs on his elbows to show that he had rolled up his sleeves. And Bush said to him, "What was his congratulatory message to Brown?"
I can't remember what did Bush.
Heck of a job, Brownie.
Yeah, something like that.
And what about when the FEMA head, Brown, was asked about the people here at the convention center?
Well, he didn't know they was here.
He said, "I don't even know that they're here."
He ran his operation from Baton Rouge. So everything that he was seeing was secondhand. Everything that he was saying was secondhand. He wasn't here. He was in living a life of luxury in Baton Rouge while people here was dying. You know, so again, it shows what we went through then. But ain't the sad part about it? It could happen today. Deja vu is alive and well here. Because if a hurricane would happen right now, we are ill-prepared for it, the same way we was ill-prepared 20 years ago.
That's Malik Rahim. Just a few weeks ago, sitting with me in the convention center in New Orleans, where so many thousands took refuge from Hurricane Katrina. Malik co-founded the Common Ground Collective, which helped bring thousands of people from all over the world to help rebuild New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. He was also one of the founders of the New Orleans chapter of the Black Panther Party. When we come back, we stay in New Orleans and speak with independent journalist Jordan Flaherty. Back in 20 seconds.
Say, Big Chief, coming, don't go nowhere. Shallow water, oh mama. They raising hell, they say everywhere. Shallow water, oh mama. They open and how y'all let them come. Shallow water, oh mama. Say, Big Chief, coming on, they won't run. Shallow water, oh mama. They meet everybody with a feather in his head. Shallow water, oh mama. They print on face, print is red. Shallow water, oh mama. They open and how they jumping up and down. Shallow water, oh mama. They mean this big shape we gon' climb. Shallow water, oh mama. They be over here by the bank street. Shallow water, oh mama. We got the suit, they gotta be. Shallow water, oh mama. Oh, the sun is shining, it's really hot. Shallow water, oh mama. I don't know much longer, gon' keep this rock. Shallow water, oh mama.
Say hey, little girl, and hey, little boy.
Scenes of Mardi Gras Indians in the streets of New Orleans when Democracy Now! Was there in 2006. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York with Amy Goodman in Telluride, Colorado. We're continuing our coverage of the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, the 2005 storm that devastated the Gulf Coast, killing more than 1,800 people and forcing over a million people to evacuate.
We're joined now in New Orleans by independent journalist Jordan Flaherty, who was in New Orleans when the hurricane hit, returned to the city soon after being evacuated to help with relief efforts and to report on what was happening in the streets, particularly to the poor Black communities that were most affected by the hurricane. He's won awards for his reporting on people left behind in the New Orleans City Jail after the hurricane, and is the author of Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gina 6. He's joined us many times over the years. I was just with you, Jordan, in New Orleans at Netroots Nation, where you moderate a panel on Hurricane Katrina 20 years later. Can you speak now about the aftermath? Talk about what was happening then from the complete lack of FEMA preparedness or the city's preparedness to climate change, to what happened to this population where more than, well, close to 2,000 people died and 100,000 were evacuated.
Thank you, Amy. And sitting here in this chair, I think about all the people that aren't in this chair. As you say, the people that were displaced, the people that were killed. New Orleans right now has a population of about 360,000. Pre-Katrina, it was about 480,000. And most of that is Black residents. The city has about 120,000 fewer Black residents than it did pre-Katrina. And that period right after the storm, it feels a lot like right now, the way right now we're feeling attacks on everything, on democracy, on the social safety net. That's how it felt after Katrina. We're facing the issues people face everywhere, housing, education, criminal justice, but it was like on hyperspeed. Overnight, you had 80% of the city, of the city's housing, you know, unlivable. You had the entire public housing infrastructure shut down. Almost all the public housing was shut down, even that was undamaged. You had our free city hospital was closed down. The entire staff of the school system was fired. Overnight, 7,500 teachers, the largest union in the city, that union representing the teachers, ceased to be recognized. The schools were moved from control of the school board, so under electoral control, to a mostly charter system. You had the governor say, I'm sending in National Guard troops. They're locked and loaded. They've been trained to shoot to kill, and I expect they will. And the voices of especially Black New Orleanians were not heard. I know that you've lifted up voices like Norris Henderson, Monique Hardin, Tracy Washington, Sonny Patterson, people that were on the front lines of this struggle, artists, organizers, scholars, incredible landscape of people fighting for the city. And people won real victories in that struggle. And, you know, it's hard living in the city, but I've learned so much from the grassroots organizers on the front line that were fighting for justice for this city.
And Jordan, could you talk about what happened with the domestic, the federal funding that was given to New Orleans in the aftermath of Katrina, more than $140 billion, which is the largest post-disaster domestic recovery effort in U.S. history. What happened to that funding?
You know, it felt in that period as if, like, the sky was filled with money. As you say, all this money that came from the government and also from people that were donating. It was like it flew over our heads and then got redirected, so we didn't actually get to, the people most in need didn't actually receive it. So much of that money went to the Bush cronies like Kellogg, Brown and Root and Halliburton. Of the 25 nonprofits that received the most money for Gulf Coast aid, half of them were based outside of the Gulf Coast. There was all of people giving money, the government giving money. If you look at the Louisiana Road Home Program, which was state administered and federally funded, one of the biggest sources of funding, it just went to homeowners, which were certainly in need. But what about renters? What about the homeless? And even among homeowners, white homeowners got 35% more aid on average than Black homeowners. So the people most in need, the people that were most highly victimized, the neighborhoods that were most in need, received the least aid. And much of that aid that was allocated, it took years to come through, some of it through mismanagement, other reasons. Some of that money still has not come.
You know, the criminalization of storm survivors, on the one hand, they're left to drown. 1,800 people died in Hurricane Katrina. When did the federal authorities come out? How were the people who were so desperate, as thousands went into the convention center, into the Superdome, how were they seen? We just saw excerpts of our coverage where people were talking about Black people described as looters, white people described as desperately trying to find food for their families, the National Guard coming out, being told to shoot to kill. Describe that whole scene, including the Danziger Bridge, that famous incident attack by police.
Danziger Bridge, it's hard to even talk about. You know, these police came rolling up to a group of unarmed civilians. We found out later that the police thought that they were coming onto another scene, and they just started shooting to kill. James Brissett, 17 years old, killed by police. Ronald Madison, mentally challenged man, killed. Others that were there wounded. The police just went up, open fire. And it was years before that story was even told by most of the media. It was mostly ignored. And when it was ignored, and when it wasn't ignored, they just told the police's end of the story. It was finally in 2008 that we really had some federal investigations of police violence in that period after the storm. But for years, our media failed to investigate. And historically, New Orleans media has failed to investigate issues in the Black community, issues of police violence. The New Orleans Times-Picayune, what was once a daily paper here, did not cover these stories, did not care about these stories. We saw it over and over and over again. Many of the people working in that paper were closer to police than they were to community members. One photographer testified that he knew things about police behavior that he didn't report at the time. They did not do their responsibility to tell the story. And as I said before, the voices of Black New Orleanians were not heard. The people who created the culture that we feel in this whole world, the music of New Orleans, the culture. They're still living here. Their voices are not heard. People are working for minimum wage jobs or less. They are living in a city with poor infrastructure. You know that if you live here, you will live in an amazing place, but also you will probably die sooner. You'll probably make less money. You'll probably have less educational opportunities. Several years ago, it was reported that one of the zip codes in New Orleans had a life expectancy of 55 years. We live right near Cancer Alley, where the chemical processing plants cause high cancer rates, especially in that area and also right near here. Those same oil and gas companies are responsible for coastal erosion. We're losing, for years it's been estimated, about a football field of land every 45 minutes, this coastal erosion, much of that caused by the oil and gas pipelines that bring the salt water into the freshwater marshes. That makes us more vulnerable to hurricanes. Of course, climate change makes us more vulnerable. And this current administration is doing everything to make us more vulnerable, including, as you recently reported, gutting FEMA once again.
And talk about the significance of that, Jordan. I mean, as Malik Rahim, who Amy Goodman spoke to, as he said, and you've just repeated, that something like Katrina could happen very easily again. And specifically, these cuts to FEMA, because poor climate vulnerable states like Louisiana received the most direct assistance from FEMA between January 2015, that is, so almost 10 years after Hurricane Katrina, between January 2015 and April 2024. So what will this mean for the city and for the state?
It's devastating. It's devastating. The support for the oil and gas industry, the heightened climate change, hurricanes getting bigger, hurricanes getting stronger, less land to protect us in the city, less infrastructure to support us, less of a social safety net, less medical, a huge increase in policing. You know, one of the victories that organizers won here after Hurricane Katrina was shrinking the size of the city jail, was getting oversight over, federal oversight over the police department, also an independent police monitor, federal oversight over the jail. All of those kind of things are going out the window. Our new governor is pushing to undo decades of reform of the policing, of the prison industrial complex in the state. More people getting locked up, more people being criminalized, less ways to afford to live in this city, in this country.
Jordan, before we go, I'm just interrupting because we have less than a minute. Talk about the prisoners, people held in the parish jails, what they faced at that time, often just awaiting trial, stuck in the dark, in the filth.
Right. We're talking about many people who had just been arrested a day or two before for some minor charge like public drunkenness. The city jail before Katrina was the largest city jail in the country, 7,000 people being held there. The New Orleans police were arresting 60,000 people every year. That's in a city of less than 500,000 people. Do the math on that. You had 95% of those arrested were arrested for nonviolent offenses. When the floodwaters were rising, people were left to die. When they finally were rescued, they were shipped to maximum security prisons around the state, like Angola State Prison. Many people were lost in the system for months. I remember nearly a year later, advocates found a woman who had been lost in the system. She didn't
Jordan,
even know
I'm
why
afraid
she'd
we're
going
to have to leave it there, but we will continue covering the 20-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina tomorrow. Thanks so much for joining us, Jordan Flaherty, New Orleans-based independent journalist and film producer, author of Floodlines. Thanks so much for joining us. More of our coverage tomorrow.
Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.